for now, we move on to the Asia-Pacific report. And talking about, or rather our discussion, beginning our discussion about the on the Asia-Pacific report, well, October the 25th, President Xi Jinping attended the conference marking the 50th anniversary of the restoration of the lawful seat of the People's Republic of China in the United Nations. Apparently an important day, you know, for the Chinese, that sort of like a global recognition being extended to the country. To talk on this matter and others, Sanusha Naidu, Senior Research Associate based with the Institute for Global Dialogue with the Asia-Pacific Report. Good morning, Sanusha.
Good morning, Junaid.
And thank you for joining us. President Xi Jinping marks China's 50th anniversary at the UN. How significant a date is this for China?
I think it's really significant because you must remember that China, when it became independent in 1949, it wasn't recognized at the UN, despite the fact that China did play an instrumental role in terms of the formation of the UN, in terms of the architecture and the negotiations that took place. But it was Taiwan that occupied the seat at the UN Security Council, which is considered to be the powerhouse of the UN more broadly. And that's where a lot of debate happens around the reforming of the UN right now, whether that UN Security Council needs to be expanded and the question of the veto right. So in 15 years ago, when China rightfully and perhaps legitimately claimed that it was the one China that needed to represent all of China, and that was Taiwan, Macau, Hong Kong, etc., then there was this question about how would this go about. And I think it was quite interesting to note that it was African countries in the General Assembly who essentially supported the proposal of China to become the rightful country to assume the chair in the Security Council. But it was also a little conversation that Henry Kissinger had with his counterparts in the U.S., because at the time, in the early 70s, there was a softening or a thawing of relations between Washington and Beijing. Now, it's quite amazing and significant that we've come full circle there, where we see this heightened tension starting off in the Trump era and, of course, continuing with the Biden presidency around China and the containment of China. So I think for China, this recognition, as you rightly point out, is quite important because it's not just a recognition of China as the country that occupies the seat in the UN Security Council, but it's the global recognition of China's One China policy. And I think in many ways, the speech that President Xi Jinping made in terms of celebrating that 50th year anniversary of China's return, and we put that in inverted commas, to the UN Security Council, actually reaffirms a lot what you now currently see with China's greater incorporation of other issues, particularly the question of Taiwan. We've seen in the context of Hong Kong how that's played out. We know Macau is part of the whole Greater China Incorporated, but it also plays to significant milestones. This is the 100-year anniversary of the formation of the Chinese Communist Party. The Chinese government has set themselves very strategic milestones and political and global benchmarks. And so, and of course, they're currently in this current five-year plan, which talks about dual circulation, which is about stimulating the domestic economy, consumption, but also it's about common prosperity because, you know, in terms of inequality, it's quite an important dynamic for the Chinese to not just talk about poverty and alleviation, but it's also about the question of how do you level the equitable distribution of resources in society. And so this is where China wants to be by 2049. The project is to be successful both in terms of its One China policy, but also be successful in terms of the Chinese state with the One China policy, but with social characteristics defined by China.
Sanusha, moving on to India, the Pegasus found. And that's, of course, the information, you know, leaking or the snooping on information of political leaders and those of the society's elite. India's top court orders probe into snooping allegations. What's happening with the investigation into the Pegasus, Raul?
Well, as you know, Junaid, in July, when this whole issue around Pegasus was unveiled, it caused quite a stir, and it's continuing to cause quite a lot of concern, because the breaking of the story was that an Israeli company called NSO was contracted or had this database that included the telephone numbers, the contact details, and all kinds of other information that connected to governments, to business, to activists, to people who were in either a high-profile social positions, political positions, community positions, and so forth. And the leak actually claimed that it was a database of about 500,000 numbers, and that linked to this tracking or the surveillance of people's activities, both online and offline, but also it was countries that were implicated as well, or heads of state, rather, that were implicated in this Pegasus, that essentially you could employ commercially this company to track the activity of your opponents. So it's the biggest, I think, in my opinion, the biggest online surveillance project that was conducted that showed how vulnerable we are in the fourth IR when it comes to data, when it comes to technology. And in the case of the Indian context, the court has now appointed an independent commission or independent tribunal to investigate where the breach happened, how this happened, and who were the people being tracked. I think there's reportedly around about 300 Indian individuals who are basically have been on this database. It includes the opposition party leaders, it includes activists, it includes individuals, and we just don't know how deep it goes, not just in the case of India, but I think globally as well. And what activists in India have been arguing is that there needs to be investigation of how this happened, particularly who actually leaked the names of these 300 individuals to be put on this database that was run by the Israeli company, whilst the Israeli company claims that it hasn't done any kind of anything unlawful, and it hasn't breached any of the business or civilian or ethics or whatever. The problem with the Pegasus issue is that somewhere someone has access to your online footprint, and it means that countries, particularly where countries or where there is serious challenges to the democratic dividend, it's going to be a key problem in terms of how you track your opponents. And I think this is perhaps why India has put up, the Indian government and the Supreme Court, rather, has put up this commission, because it makes the situation and infringes on democratic rights, civil liberties, but it also makes democracy vulnerable. So, you know, it's a story that's continuously going to be in the making. It's going to continuously evolve. And I'm just wondering whether in South Africa we have also decided to do something similar, because we've also been on that list.
Moving on to Japan, Sarusha, Japan's Princess Mako finally marries commoner boyfriend Kai Komuro. Japan has been, well, traditionally a feudal society, wherein you had a major difference between the royal elite and the common folk. Well, is this being eroded? And who, in fact, is President, Princess Mako? How significant of a role does the royal family and the elite play in Japan's politics these days?
Well, Princess Mako, you know, she's quite an interesting individual. She is, if I understood it correctly, she is actually the eldest child of the current emperor of Japan, his brother, younger brother. And what's interesting about Japanese royal family is that, like royal families around the world, they have very specific traditions and very specific ceremonial positions in society. I think, every one of us or some of us who have love affairs with royal families, and we are constantly watching what happens and how they actually conduct their public life, etc. It's the same tradition in Japan. But I think in Japan it has a bigger structure, particularly in terms of how the royal family becomes these guardians of society in a muted way. So what Princess Mako has done is that she has decided that she will essentially go against tradition and not marry someone within royal tradition, royal blood, etc. And of course, she decided to marry the young man that she fell in love with at university. She also bucked tradition and didn't go through the traditional university space of education. She went and decided to have the university experience in the UK. Now, what's interesting is that I think in Japan, if a female descendant of the royal house decides to marry outside of the royal bloodline or outside of what is considered to be the royal bloodline, she forfeits her status. And that's quite interesting. And eventually, after much contestation, she was eventually allowed to marry her fiancé in a closed, quiet affair. But it also means that, like in the UK, where Harry has, also decided to challenge the boundaries of the royal house of Windsor, I think Princess Mako has done the same in the Japanese royal house.
Sunisha Nagu, thank you for joining us for the Asia Pacific Report, as always, and have yourself a good weekend ahead and a good election day. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Junaid. Same to you, and happy elections.